This is the big development story that no one talks about.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. How does the public sector buy electricity? In developing countries, the power sector uses long-term, rigid contracts called power purchase agreements, PPAs, between a private supplier and government-owned utilities. Well, if you've never heard of them, like me until recently, or have never wondered how they work, you're like everyone else. But I can guarantee that new research that examines the nature of these contracts, it's going to make your jaw drop. Suganda Srivastav, of the University of Oxford, is one of the researchers who has investigated these contracts. She joins me now. Suganda, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you so much for having me, Tim.
Suganda, this is something that I had never really thought about. So let's talk about these contracts. First of all, how important is access to electricity and the price at which that electricity is bought in economic development?
It's hard to overstate just how important this is. Electricity is key to economic development, and the aim for most developing nations is universal access. That is our North Star. That's where we want to get to. But a key element of that is to make sure that this electricity is affordable, because if it's not, people simply can't use it. A key part of this work, which I think makes it super exciting, is that it finds a completely different and novel reason for why electricity turns out not to be affordable in many developing countries.
Who is generating this electricity in developing countries?
Essentially, it is motley crew of independent power producers whose ultimate investors can range from those coming from Saudi Arabia to some being very local to even Chinese investment. But what's really critical here is that in many parts of the world, these power contracts were not competitively procured.
Right.
They were simply bilaterally negotiated. And I think that's one key piece of context to understand, because as we know, without competitive procurement, you don't really have a guarantee that you're getting the best value for money.
I would have assumed that given the number of producers of electricity, that all these contracts would be negotiated competitively. And you're saying that's just not the case.
No. So let me back up here and tell you some context. In the 1990s, most developing countries had a power sector that was publicly owned and managed. There was no private investment. Then around 93, 94, countries like India, Pakistan, and Indonesia decided they wanted to open up their economy to private investment. Private investors were uncertain about what investment in these countries would look like. They rightly said, look, this seems a little risky. We need to have some guarantees. We need to know that we're going to make an adequate return. Unfortunately, what then ended up happening was, because investors put forth this claim that they're not ready to come in without certain provisions, we saw the development of purely negotiated contracts that were extremely investor-friendly. The question here we really ask is, how lopsided were these contracts? And what was the price of being excessively investor-friendly?
So these contracts are the power purchase agreements, the PPAs. How does a PPA work?
So Tim, if you're independent power producer and I'm the Pakistani government,
Okay. We're
going to sit across the table. And essentially the standard contract format is cost plus. So that means that if your coal costs go up, you don't need to worry about it. The Pakistani government is going to reimburse you for any increase in coal input costs.
Wow.
So that's what a cost plus contract means. Now, feature number two, they have capacity payments. So Tim, even if you produce electricity that I don't need because demand ends up being much lower, or we just got our forecast wrong and the Pakistani economy doesn't grow by as much as we thought, then there's no problem for you because the Pakistani government is going to pay the independent power producer a fixed monthly lump sum, regardless of how much electricity is even bought. Even if zero electricity is bought, you're going to get this fixed lump sum for a very long time. And that brings me to my third point. The contracts are exceptionally long. They will last from 25 to 30 years.
30 years.
Exactly. They'll offer you a fixed guaranteed return on equity, which is promised through a mathematical formula. And on top of that, they will offer government guarantees such as payments in dollars. So it doesn't matter if the government has a shortage of foreign exchange, you're going to get your dollar denominated payments. So in a nutshell, there's a lot of risks that private firms usually face, and some of these emanate from the market, some of these emanate from policy. But in this contract, the burden of risk is shifted from the private firm to the public utility. And as you can imagine, this ends up having a huge impact on the incentives for the private electricity generator.
I'm glad you said that I was the private electricity generator because it sounds like I'm much better off. From what you're saying, my costs go up. It doesn't matter. Demand is low. I win. Demand is high. I win double. These are extraordinary contracts because they also go on more or less forever in business terms. How come we know so little about this? How come this is the first time that I'm finding out about the extraordinary structure of these PPAs?
This is one of those boring topics that you think won't matter, but turns out to affect more than half of the planet's population.
Oh.
Yeah, these PPAs in this format are across Indonesia, India, China, Ghana, Zambia, Nigeria. This is the big development story that no one talks about. And I'll tell you why, Tim. It's because these power purchase agreements are seldom disclosed. Independent power producers, like yourself now, as have made you out to be, say that the government cannot disclose these contracts because they contain proprietary information. The irony here is that even though public funds are being used to support the purchase of power, the public does not know under what contractual terms their money is being spent. Now, Pakistan was an exception because the regulator in Pakistan actually dumped this information on a corner of their website, and we then spent a year making that information usable.
You chose Pakistan because you found that there was some information here. How complete is that information? In what format does it show up?
To Pakistan's credit, every single power contract is on the internet. Now, that doesn't mean it's in a usable format, but every single tariff agreement and amendment is there. And by the way, we picked Pakistan because it was one of the only countries we could find that at least had the raw data dump. Then what we had to do subsequently is to go over 6,205 PDFs that were not machine readable. So these are the contracts and their various amendments, and track the evolution of around 26 variables over 30 years to get the full picture of how much Pakistani citizens are paying to independent power producers. And it's only after this painstaking exercise that we were finally able to get some transparency on what is actually going on and how is public money actually being spent. It was a forensic exercise and required a huge level of detail because, as you can appreciate, Tim, these contracts are hugely complex.
Mm-hmm.
They are very detailed, and you need each piece of the information on how debt repayments work, how payment for equity works, in order to get the full picture of what this actually costs the average Pakistani citizen.
It's not surprising that you know exactly how many of these contracts there were, because you have looked at all of these and you have searched them for information, like you say, that would probably be expressed in slightly different forms in every contract. Am I right?
The issue is that these are not machine readable. And of course, there has been an issue with different contract terms. As I said, each contract was negotiated bilaterally. So you have small differences that creep up. It required a forensic comb to go through this. And actually, part of the question we're really interested in is that when we see a contract that's particularly generous and we can't explain that from economic 101 principles, then we want to know who was behind that contract. Who was the counterparty that was able to negotiate terms and conditions that cannot be rationalized through first principles?
What have you found out from this about the structure of Pakistan's PPA contracts?
Gosh, it's been a treasure trove, but let me tell you one high-level result that was really staggering for us.
Mm-hmm.
So once we got this data, we were able to see that annual capacity payments, so those fixed lump sum payments that are delinked from generation, are 6 times Pakistan's annual healthcare budget.
What?
And this capacity, Tim, I hate to break it to you, around half of it sits idle. It's not even used. So you can't even say that this is helping system reliability or that it's meeting shortfalls. Actually, a huge chunk, more than half, is just not used and not needed. And yet, people still pay for it.
So to clarify, these power generators are being paid literally to do nothing in that case.
Yes, and this is the interesting thing. Let me tell you how it works. Because if a firm only gets payment for what it sells, which is how most market economies work, the firm really thinks about, is my product needed, right? Are the electrons I generate actually needed in the marketplace? Are they demanded? Because in a normal market economy, the revenue fundamentally depends on that calculation. But now, if I tell a power producer, no worries, you're going to get a fixed monthly payment no matter how much you sell, the power firm doesn't really need to think so much about whether its power even has a market. It can just enter because it knows that it's feather-bedded.
Mm-hmm. Now, every contract is an allocation of risk and reward between the parties of the contract. What is this telling us about where the risk and the reward sit?
Yes. So I like a principle in contract law, which says that when you sign a long-term contract, you need an equitable distribution of risk.
Mm-hmm.
And because a long-term contract is really a relationship between two parties, and so much can change over the duration of that contract. And yet, what we see in these contracts is an extremely lopsided distribution of risk, with the vast majority of risk being on the public and very, very little risk being on the private firm. And in terms of the reward, let me tell you what that translates into. It translates into staggeringly high return on equity. So the return on equity we see in Pakistan is 30% in some of the coal contracts signed under the China's Belt and Road Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
Now, coal is a very mature technology, Tim. Normally, we see those types of high mandated return on equities for novel, new technologies that do not have a proven track record. I think it's very hard to explain that high premium for a very mature technology. But more than that, we actually find that the real return on equity sometimes is 80% higher because these contracts enable cheating. So let me explain this to your listeners. Remember how I said the contracts are cost plus?
Yep.
And the government can reimburse the power firm for any increases in coal or gas prices and other inputs? This creates an incentive to doctor receipts and make your costs look even higher than they actually are, because every single cost increase gets reimbursed. So we go one step further and we compare audit reports, which have actual financials, to what these power firms say their costs are. And we find huge discrepancies. And essentially what they're doing is they're taking advantage of the cost plus contract feature and lying about their costs. So let me give one very specific example. Sahiwal Power Plant in Pakistan, and I can say this because it's now in the public domain, mm-hmm. was using coal that was of a lower quality and much cheaper than what it said it was using. So it mm-hmm. told the government it was using coal that was of a much higher quality, and it was reimbursed for this higher quality coal. So it pocketed the price differential, and that turned out to be excess rents for Sahiwal Power Plant. Now, I'd love to say Sahiwal is a one-off, but sadly, it's not. Cost-plus contracting creates huge incentives, Eli.
With a lot of these contracts, when there is a mixed market where there are some bilateral contracts and some are competitive, then you have a benchmark for the bilateral contracts, which acts as a discipline on the negotiators. It also means that people like yourself can quite easily back out what the excess profits are. Might be. In this case, it's been a lot more difficult, but you still seem to have arrived at some numbers.
So there's two ways we go about this. One is we can look at the explicit fraud, and I'm using that term because if they lie, then that's even deviating from the lopsided contract. So for example, we can see instances where, as I said before, the audit reports do not match up to what they say their costs are. And that in itself accounts for a very large chunk of the excess profits. So mm-hmm. that is one element here. The other element is that even though Pakistan itself hasn't done competitive procurements, we can use some benchmarks. So for example, one power plant in Pakistan was saying its coal costs are 4 times the market rate. Now, where are they sourcing coal from? That gives us some benchmark, right? We do know what market rates should look like. And if we're seeing deviations of 4x, then that raises some very interesting questions. And we can do calculations based on that, right? We can say, well, what if they were sourcing coal competitively at the market rate? How much cheaper would that make electricity for Pakistan citizens? Now, remember, Tim, they have no incentive to source coal from the cheapest rate because they never pay for their own coal. So what ends up happening is I think many power plants engage in patronage as opposed to finding the supplier that reflects value for money. And so we have a lot of these nice ways to get at how much more expensive electricity becomes because of these various types of cheating and the deviations that we find are much easier to defend. And that allows us a way to get at the fact that we're seeing this electricity that's far more expensive. And by the way, Pakistan just has electricity that is much more expensive than other parts of the world, including the US, despite being much poorer.
So put some numbers on this for me. How does this affect Pakistan's economy?
The debt is 5% of GDP.
Hang on, stop. 5% of GDP?
Yes. The debt emanating from this is 5% of GDP. It's massive.
Oh my.
How massive is it? This was a key part of the IMF 2024 bailout package for Pakistan. Now, let me put another number on that. 1/5 of that debt is owed to China. And because Chinese power purchase agreements under the Belt and Road Initiative had amongst the highest return on equities we've seen of any power purchase agreement, the IMF now came in and said it's not going to bail out the Chinese portion of the debt because China signed these contracts knowing that there would be the IMF backstop, which mm-hmm. creates a moral hazard because normally investors should think about default as a true, genuine risk. But if a foreign entity comes in and it knows the IMF is always the last resort and will bail it out, then as a lender, you're not afraid to charge conditions that can result in default. So this is a very interesting geopolitical dimension of power purchase agreements. And the Chinese fraction of debt, as I said, is a huge part of this story.
Scandal is not a big enough word for some of the things that you have explained to me. Can we distinguish between incompetence on behalf of the people negotiating these contracts in the public sector and corruption when these contracts were made?
Yes, I think we can, and I think both are at play.
Right.
So let me give an example of incompetence. In 2015, 7 gigawatts of Chinese-funded coal was signed on through power purchase agreements in Pakistan. 7 gigawatts is a huge number, okay? Ghana uses about 5 gigawatts for context. Now, this coal was signed in on 2015. Tim, do you know when solar became cheaper than coal?
I imagine you're going to tell you about this, Doc.
Exactly. It happened around this time, officially 2 years later.
Yeah.
But as you'll remember, these contracts last for 30 years. So now, till 2040 and beyond, this coal is going to sit in the system, even though solar became cheaper at exactly that moment. Now, this is incompetence because you're literally baking in more expensive electricity for an entire generation, not doing your number calculations properly. Because if anyone sat down at that point and did the math, they would know solar would have a lower levelized cost of electricity. Not only that, you don't need to import sunshine, but Pakistan totally needs to import coal. It is a net importer of coal. From a development perspective, it's also locking itself into the currency-related risk and the import risk that comes with fuel imports. So that is a clear example of incompetence that comes in the form of lack of foresight. The second part of your question is linked to corruption. And I'm going to tell you one very interesting anecdote here. We find that a lot of power purchase contracts have the textile industry behind them. So actually, textile firms are big owners of power plants in Pakistan.
Really?
But this should raise really big questions because textile firms are the biggest claimants of electricity subsidies in Pakistan. So textile firms say, government, electricity is so expensive. We want to be competitive with India and Bangladesh. Therefore, give us subsidies on electricity. We need it because it's a big input of ours. But then you look at the question of why is electricity so expensive and who owns the electricity? And we were shocked to see that a large number of power plants are owned by these very same textile firms that complain about electricity being expensive. And it is because of the contracts they signed that they're actually earning huge rents on this electricity. So it's a classic case of double dipping. When it's convenient, they just want to appear like the consumers of electricity. But if you dig deeper and lift under the hood, they are also the producers of electricity and they earn by charging much more for it through these lucrative contracts.
We have this story that is large enough to show up in the national accounts.
Yes.
Now, regularly, I have conversations with people who are working with policymakers in Pakistan as well to try and eliminate corruption and incompetence at a much smaller scale. If you have these people who are working very hard in a well-meaning way to eliminate that, how on earth is the government allowing this to persist?
Right. This is a big question on institutional quality and why were these contracts signed in the first place? Because I think, Tim, if you look at the terms and conditions, even at the time of signing, it would have become apparent that this can lead to a debt crisis and severely misaligned incentives. Yet the contracts were signed, and I think that one of the issues is that when you do privatization without the appropriate governance reforms, then actually privatization can be used as a mechanism to move money from the public coffers to vested interests. Not just in Pakistan, but also in Indonesia, in India, in Ghana, and Zambia, we have seen the power sector being used time and time again to transfer money from the public coffers to these very concentrated interests. This is not just a Pakistan story, it's a global story. In Indonesia, the very first independent power producer had the political elite behind it. There was a court case, a litigation subsequently that took this independent power producer to court for charging excess tariffs. And it was common knowledge that Suharto was supporting that independent power producer and it had a deep political connection. So my question is, how do we create the institutional safeguards and guardrails to ensure that those in government truly are negotiating on behalf of the citizenry as opposed to small pockets of interests?
These are legal contracts. They will be in effect for another generation. Is there a possible way in the short term and the long term to get out of this problem?
And by the way, this is what connects up to net zero as well, because yes, as I said, a lot of these will simply outstrip 2050 net zero targets that are now common across the world.
Yes.
And we need to appreciate that the majority of global coal is under multi-decadal PPAs. So if you do the maths, we cannot honor these contracts and fix climate change. So let me harken back to an old concept, Tim. When things like asbestos were found to be carcinogenic, many contracts were also prematurely terminated. And there was a case that was made that honoring these contracts is not compatible with safe living, right to life, right to environment, and various legal principles that are enshrined in the Constitution. One avenue for these fossil fuel contracts is to make a similar case and go through the logic to say, well, we have an alternative way of generating electricity that is cheaper. At the same time, we know that this contract embeds a certain type of harm, and you can fight out that case. And I want to tell you that this has happened. So in Delhi, one utility went to court and litigated and said its millions of customers could get electricity that's three times cheaper and cleaner if it's able to exit its coal-based power purchase agreement. And it won the case. So this type of litigation is one pathway forward. But another option is renegotiation. And in Pakistan, one independent power producer came forward and it said it's willing to negotiate with the government to switch all payments to Pakistani rupees rather than US dollars. Because as we can appreciate, Pakistan has had severe currency depreciations and payment in US dollars is very expensive. So some renegotiation is possible. In other cases, with all Beijing-based contracts, China has been an unwilling party to renegotiate. We need serious research into how to systematically renegotiate or litigate out these contracts. There's a menu of different options available. But my last point is, for God's sake, the contracts that we write now, let's not copy and paste. Those need to be much more foresighted and flexible and ensure incentives are compatible. Because now we have seen what the PPAs of the 1990s and 2000s have done. They have led to debt crises and unreliable electricity. And we can't repeat that same mistake going forward.
I'm not sure that we've ever had a Vox Dev Talks before with larger implications for the economies of so many countries. Thank you very much for talking about it.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
Well, well, there's a much bigger chance of these contracts being negotiated fairly in future if more people read this paper. It is called The Economic Costs of Lopsided Contracts, Evidence from Pakistan's Power Sector. The authors Tim Doberman, Faraz Hayat, and Sugandha Srivastav. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you will find more information about the papers we feature. And also, if you've been listening to this and you think someone else ought to know about this, tell them about us and they can hear it too.